All that is just Persian musk and attar of roses. It has nothing whatever to do with the facts. In the first place, Potiphar did not die so early. Why should the man have died before his time, whose peculiar constitution saved him from using up his powers, who lived entirely for his own inner satisfactions, and often went bird-shooting to freshen himself up? The silence of history upon his fate after the great day of the house judgment certainly indicates his disappearance from the scene, but why draw the conclusion that he died? We must remember that while Joseph was in prison, there had been a change of rulers, and on such occasions it is the rule that the court, or some part of it, changes too. We know that Petipre had had his troubles as nominal head of troops without any real authority. Now, after the burial of Nebmare the Magnificent, he withdrew into private life, with the title and rank of unique friend. He went no more to court, needed to do so no longer in any case, and on the day of Joseph's gilding he must have refrained, obviously out of the sense of delicacy that was so strong in him. Afterwards they never did meet, the reason being, in part at least, that as master and overseer of the Department of Supplies, Joseph, as we shall see, had his residence not at Thebes, but at Memphis. Potiphar's tact was probably responsible for the rest. If, in the course of years, a chance encounter did take place, on one or other ceremonial occasion, we may be sure it went off without the flicker of an eyelash, with perfect discretion and the most deliberate ignoring of the past on both sides. It is just this situation that is reflected in the silence of the authorized tradition. The same thing applies to Mut Imenet, and on equally good grounds. Joseph did not see her again, but just as clear is it that she did not withdraw into any penitential hut, nor did she ever publicly accuse herself of shamelessness. If she had, it would have been a lie. This great lady, the instrument of Joseph's trial, which he passed by no means brilliantly, but still passed, after the shipwreck of that desperate attempt to escape into the human from her honorary existence, she was forced back, finally and forever, into the form of life which before her affliction had been the normal and familiar one to her. Indeed, she now practiced it with more pride and concentration than ever. By reason of the surpassing wisdom Potiphar had shown at the time of the catastrophe, their relations had gained in warmth, rather than the reverse. He had given judgment like a god, elevated above and beyond the frailties of the human heart. She was grateful to him, and from that day onwards was a blameless and devoted wife. She did not curse the beloved for the agony that he had brought upon her, or she had brought upon herself. No, the agonies of love are set apart. No one has ever repented having suffered them. Thou hast made rich my life. It burgeons. So had Aene spoken in the midst of her travail. It is clear that love has its own quality of torment, not always incompatible with heartfelt gratitude. At least she had lived and loved. Unhappily, of course, but is there really such a thing as unhappy love? And shall we not put aside as stupid and officious any pity we may feel for Aene? She asked for none, and she was much too proud to pity herself. Her life had had its flowering. The renunciation was stern and final. The lines of her body, for a time those of a witch for love, quickly recovered their normal state. That was no longer the swan-like beauty they had owned in youth. It was, rather, an expression of the nun-like in her nature. Yes, Mut Imenet, from now on, was a cool moon nun, chaste-bosomed, irreproachably elegant, and, it must be added, extremely bigoted. We all remember how, in the season of her painful blooming, she had burned incense with the beloved before the world-wide, omni-friendly Atum Re of On, Lord of the Wide Horizon, and prayed that he would smile upon her passion. That was all over. Her own horizon had closed round her again, and narrow, rigid, and devout it was. Her whole devotion now went to him rich in bulls of Ipet Issoet, and to his conservative son Sense. More than ever she lent her ear to the spiritual counsel of his head, Baldpate, the great Becknekans, who hated all change and frowned on all speculation. Thus she was the more estranged from the court of Amenhotep IV, where a tender, all-embracing, ecstatic cult had begun to be the mode. In Mut-Im-Enet's eyes, it had nothing whatever to do with religion. She was all for the sacred static, the eternal equilibrium of the scales, the stony stare into forever and ever. And she celebrated it when, in her tight-skirted Hathor dress, she rattled her clappers before Amun in measured dance-step, and from her shrunken bosom gave out her still admired voice to swell the choir of her noble sisterhood. And yet, at the bottom of her soul, there abode a treasure of which she was secretly prouder than of all her religious or worldly honors, and whether confessedly or not, would never have surrendered. A treasure buried very deep, yet ever it sent a warm glow upwards into the gray daylight of her resigned state. Of course the chill knowledge of defeat was there present too, in slight measure, but weak compared to the warmth from below, which imparted to her worldly and religious pride an indispensable element of the human, the pride of life. It was a memory, not so much of him who, as she had heard, was now become lord over all Egypt. He was an instrument, as she, Mut-Im-Enet, had been an instrument. Almost independent of him was her sense of having justified her own existence, her secret knowledge that she had once blossomed and burned, once suffered and loved. Lord over Egypt. Lord over Egypt, I use the phrase in the spirit of a convention, which could never go far enough in deification to satisfy itself, and in the sense of that beautiful extravagance which Pharaoh defended in favor of the interpreter of his dreams. However, it is not recklessly or fancifully used in this place, but rather with a full sense of loyalty to truth. For here, in this account, I am not drawing a long bow, but merely telling what happened. And these are two very different things, whichever one you may happen to prefer. Exaggeration does, of course, get a more striking temporary effect, but surely a critical and considered narrative is of more real profit to the listener. Joseph became a very great lord at court, and in the country, no question of that. And the confidential relations between him and the monarch after the talk in the Cretan garden room, his position as a favorite, left the limitations to his authority somewhat vague. But he was never actually lord over Egypt, or, as saga and song sometimes express it, regent of the lands. His elevation, which was fabulous enough, and his inordinate row of titles could not alter the fact that the administration of the country whither he had been snatched remained in the hands of the crown officials, some of whom had held office under King Nebmare. It would be excessive to suppose that the administration of justice, for instance, came under the authority of Jacob's son, which from time immemorial had been the business of the high judge and vizier, and now of the two viziers. The same is true of the field of foreign policy, which might indeed have had better results if Joseph had taken it over than those which history records. We must not forget that at bottom he was not interested in the glory of the kingdom, however much he had become Egyptian in his outward walks and ways, and that whatever energetic benevolence he displayed to the inhabitants, however wisely he served the public good, his inward eye ever remained directed upon the personally spiritual, the private, which was yet of such world-shaking significance, on the furtherance, in short, of plans and purposes which had little to do with Mizraim's weal or woe. We may be certain that he had at once brought Pharaoh's dreams and what they foretold into relation with his own plans and purposes. Certainly he made them fit into his ideas about expecting and preparing the way. In fact, we cannot deny that his attitude before Pharaoh's throne was a thought too eager, almost enough so to cool the sympathy which we would wish to preserve for Rachel's child, if we did not keep it in mind that Joseph regarded it as his duty to further such plans and to be as helpful as he possibly could to God in carrying them out. Well, whatever the interpretation in fact of all his string of titles, he was duly installed as Minister of Agriculture and Supplies, and in this capacity he carried through important reforms. Among them, the ground rent law, which has particularly impressed itself on history. But he never overstepped the limit of his field, however likely it is that the affairs of the treasury and the administration of the granaries were too closely connected with his own operations for his authority not to have reached out into them. For all that, designations like Lord over the Land of Egypt and Regent of the Lands remained fanciful ornamentations upon the actual situation. And something else must be taken into account, too. After the conditions that obtained during the first and decisive 10 to 14 years of his tenure of office, conditions in anticipation of which he had been installed, the importance of his particular responsibilities increased so extraordinarily as to put all the others in the shade. The famine which 5 to 7, more likely 5 years after his elevation, broke over Egypt and the neighboring provinces, made the man who had foreseen it, and knew how to help people through it, easily the most important figure in the kingdom, and his activities of more living importance than any others. It may well be a fact that judgment, if it is fundamental enough, leads back to a recognition of the soundness of the popular verdict. This being the case, we will say no more than that Joseph's position, at least for a period of years, was equal in fact to that of a lord over the land of Egypt, without whose voice no one could stir hand or foot in the two lands.